we discovered that we had to make some special assumptions regarding the parameters in order to get the weak star convergence to work. And there was also the question of, in what sense could we take a limit to get a solution to the D-bar equation? So it turns out that one has to be even a little more careful than we were at the end last time, when we chose n big enough depending on epsilon. You have to choose n big enough depending on r and epsilon. Moreover, in order to make final sense of the solution to the D-bar equation, we have to choose it n to be even bigger than that. But we can easily write it out. So I'm just recalling this to remind you what we did last time. I'm going to give a name to that, the support of mu, the LR, or at least the support of the, when R is a parameter small. KJ are the hyperbolic squares. We chose this discrete approximation to the mass of mu in KJ. And then we looked at this approximating measure, mu R epsilon n. And the claim was that these things will converge weak star. So those things converge weak star if what happens? If the error measure, so the error measure also depends on all the parameters, but I haven't put it in. This is just the sum over the J's, KJ intersect LR, not empty. mu KJ delta ZJ minus mu R epsilon N. This actually also depends on R epsilon N. So what do I mean by the error measure? I don't mean the error from mu. I mean the error from where you don't approximate. You don't approximate mu by a special fraction times yj. You just leave it alone, because these things clearly tend weak star. The only issue is what happens if you make that approximation there. Does it still tend weak star? Well, one way to get it to tend weak star, if the error measure satisfies, let's call it 1, we just want the total mass to go to 0. However, you can dominate the total mass. I won't. It's some constant times, well, obviously it's the number of J's equal to or less than the cardinality of the J's, such that KJ intersect LR is non-empty, divided by 2nr. So that's like just an obvious upper bound. That's because the if the difference of those things is yj over 2n. And the yj's are at most 1 over r, right? From the picture up there. Yeah, it's the obvious discretization. This one is the measure that, in that original picture, if we had just replaced the mass of u in each box by its total mass there, that measure clearly tends weak star, just by the continuity of the function you test against. So the only issue is what happens when we mess it up a little bit by changing the mass to be this nearest fraction. That could, and in fact, if you look at cases, special case, you can clearly convince yourself that this error could really be quite huge. I mean, the error can be this much every time, plus even if you take away the absolute values, the errors could accumulate. So, I mean, it really could be that bad. And so basically, the worst it can be is you take the yj and dominate it by 1 over r, and then you just take the 2n, and then you take up the sum up all the j's for which this happens. Now, the sum of the j's for which the kj intersects that thing is certainly some multiple of the hyperbolic measure, or the invariant measure of LR. You know, lambda here is just this. Well, in the disk, I don't know what it is. In the disk, it's 1 minus. In the disk, it's dz over 1 minus z squared. And there's an obvious counterpart in the upper half plane. Just look it up. It's the thing that. Anyway, I don't know. I'll just let you think about it. It's probably y squared dx dy. Probably. 1 over y squared dx dy. It should look like distance to the boundary square. But whatever it is, it's the one that assigns mass 1 to each one of these squares. So you're going to get some constant times that divided by what? Well, in this LR, the actual disks that we look at have radius epsilon, so there's actually an extra epsilon squared there. Because there's epsilon squared kj's in each unit box, right? Ah, now we have colored chalk. So the other day I took this to be a quarter. Right? Every one of these was made into a quarter. And you can see that there's roughly epsilon squared of these things in each unit one. So this just counts the number of unit boxes. Divide by epsilon squared, you get them all. Okay, so we need that this thing goes to zero as r epsilon goes to zero and n goes to infinity. So you just have to make sure that n is chosen big enough compared to r and epsilon. Right. When I say converges weak star, what I could say is you take a sequence of R's, epsilons, and capital N's, a sequence indexed by K, and you make sure that N sub K is whatever, satisfies this, goes to zero. Okay, that's good. One other thing we need is that, so also, provided, now this is number two, so this is number one, provided two, that the mass is equal to or less than r over two, we get a couple of things about Carlson measures, which we also want to know, and then that's so the mu epsilon r n in the Carlson norm is equal to or less than 2. And also the cardinality. Yeah. Total variation. That's what it means. Total variation. So you put absolute values on the things. We also want the sum of the zeta j's in PQ to be equal to or less than 3n. This also requires that. The reason, I don't want to go through all the proofs again, but the reason is that when you work out the Carlson measure norm of this thing, you get two pieces. One is the Carlson measure norm of this, which is fine, because it's assumed to be good, and then there's the error. So to estimate the error term, you just use the worst possible thing, and that is the total variation of R divided by the side length of the cube, Q. for which you're taking remember when you're No, we haven't done anything about Carlson norms. Carlson measure norm is different. The Carlson measure norm is the soup of mu of something divided by a side length. It's different. It's not just the mass. So, but the point is, if you look at, but if you estimate the error term in the Carlson measure by the total mass over L of Q, that I claim is equal to or less than that. Because if the cube Q has side length less than R, it won't reach the support of mu R. Right? Remember, the support of mu R is down here. So if your cube has side length too small, it won't reach. So therefore, you've got to have at least R there. And that means that the error term contributes no more than, you know, just as much as the main term. And there's one third thing which I want to put down, and that is that I guess it was the measure I called, in my notes, I don't know what I called it last time, but the Carlson measure of mu yl. This is one of the measures you get after you separate the sequence into 6n disjoint pieces, and this Carlson measure is equal to or less than 4. And again, it's the same trick. You just do this. So you need property 1 in order for the weak star convergence inside. You need property 2 in order to get uniform Carlson measure estimates. And there's even a stronger one. We'll need that this is actually little o of r to get our interpretation of the solution to D-bar equation. And that's the thing we haven't done yet. But let me, first of all, just remind you what the conclusion is once you've done all this. The conclusion is that dz-bar of ur epsilon n at z is d mu r epsilon n of z with uniform L infinity bounds on the boundary. Right, that's the whole point of the Peter Jones construction. Was to give you these functions. U have the form a nice function divided by a Brashka product whose ddz bar is exactly this point mass. I mean, that was his construction, and he managed to get it with uniform. What do I mean by uniform L infinity bounds? The L infinity norm is bounded by the original Carlson measure norm of mu, which we're assuming is 1. So these are just absolute constants, but they really depend on the Carlson measure norm. That's the point, rather than something else. Maybe I'll emphasize that. Depending only on Carlson measure norm of mu. That's the whole point. Okay. Now, we'd like to take a limit. To make suitable sense of a limit of this equation. There's an obstacle which we get around in a very tricky way. The obstacle is trying to prove that U R epsilon n converges in some reasonable sense, I mean some weak sense. It turns out to be quite simple, however, to pass to the boundary and just use Green's theorem instead. So, we pass to the boundary. This is just a catchphrase. This doesn't mean anything, okay? We pass to the boundary using Green's theorem. So this phrase simply is a description of what we're about to do. it doesn't contain any rigorous content. So here's the rigorous content. We have uniform L infinity bounds of these guys. Remember, these guys were also nice functions, right? UR epsilon n was in C1 of the upper half plane and continuous on the boundary, so that everything made sense and it was attached to its boundary values. And now, the set UR epsilon n is contained in a fixed ball in L infinity of the boundary. So some multiple of the unit ball in L infinity. Now we use the fact, this is something that came up earlier. I remember Nir asked about this. And we are going to use it here, and that is the fact that when a Banach space is separable, then if you look at the dual, of course you have the Banach-Alagu theorem that says that a fixed closed ball in the norm L infinity topology happens to be compact in weak star. But in fact, if the original space is separable, L1 here is the pre-dual, it's separable, then in fact, when restricted to that compact set, the weak star topology is metrizable. You just use the countable family of semi-norms and you sum it up. And anyway, so I put that in the appendix. It's just standard functional analysis. So the set is contained in the fixed ball. Since L1 is separable, the closed unit ball is weak star compact, and the weak star topology is metrizable. It's important that that you restrict to the compact sets. Rudin, in his book on functional analysis, gives counterexamples where the weak star topology on the whole space L infinity is not metrizable, but it is metrizable when restricted to it. Yes. I'll just put unit underneath it. Okay, so since L1 is separable, the unit ball in L infinity, the dual space, the unit ball in the dual space turns out to be weak star compact and metrizable in that topology. That means we can take a subsequence, or a sequence of these things, which converges weak star on the boundary. Not everywhere inside, but at least on the boundary. So we can choose a sequence of these functions converging weak star to U on the boundary. Of course, U will be in L infinity. Okay, what else can we do? Well, we can also arrange to have these measures converge weak star to something, but we would like to try and avoid the complications of this thing for the moment. So instead, we use Green's theorem before we take the limit. So we can choose a sequence of these functions up ahead. Now, an application of Green's theorem, and as Garnett points out, he uses the residue theorem. It's true too, or the residue theorem. Yields what? If we integrate our UR epsilon n z times f of z dz, and I'll say yields for f in H1. I'll put H1 of D, so note we are reverting to the disk to avoid problems at infinity in the upper half space. Garnett does this too. If you remember from the beginning, we always chose to work either in the upper half space or the disk, depending on whether or not something happened. If we were using that uniform separation condition back in Carlson's interpolation theorem, we like to work on the upper half plane because Blaschke products were so simple, right? At least if we made the assumption that the measure was also in a compactly supported thing. It was so simple. However, it has the disadvantage that when you have to use Cauchy's theorem about things going off to infinity, then you have to be careful about the contours and the limiting. So what we do at this point, after we have taken the weak star limit, at this point we just pretend we've now done all this in the disk. And we have our UR epsilon n's defined in the disk, and they're continuous up to the boundary, and there's a sequence of them that converges weak star to a bounded function on the circle, on the boundary. And now we're going to apply Green's theorem to the trace, that is the boundary values of U. U is continuous up to the boundary. So the boundary values times an H1 function on the disk. And for that, we use Green's theorem. So what does Green's theorem say? Green's theorem says that this is the same as integrating over the disk. And what do? You simply take d of this form. So if we take d of this form, the only thing we're going to get is the dz bar part. So it's d dz bar of u r epsilon n times f z dz bar wedge dz. That's Green's theorem, or Stokes' theorem, in the plane. And now here, of course, f is holomorphic, so the ddz bar doesn't hit f. It just hits the u. But the u equals the measure d mu. Now at this point, so we get f of z, and then the ddz bar of this thing gives you mu, so it turns out to be d mu r epsilon n of z. Well, and of course, the way I've done it here using Green's theorem, you have to fuss a little bit about what this is. Actually, I suppose I have to have 2 pi i's in it. Let me check the formula first. Yes, so it's 1 over 2 pi I equals 1 over 2 pi I. And then this guy becomes 2i times dx dy. So you just get a 1 over pi. And well, I don't know what happened to the 1 over pi. If you use the residue theorem, you get exactly this, yeah, but that means you have to go back to the actual formula for this from the Peter Jones theorem. It writes it as a sum of things, 1 over z minus, and you use the residue theorem. Okay, I'm not sure what happened to the pi. Somewhere in there, there's a pi. Well, put it this way, I don't know what, you know, it doesn't really matter what the constant is, because whatever it is in the end, you adjust the other thing to cancel it. I mean, I don't know why it didn't work out. I'll have to check it, obviously, before I... So the plan is to put out a new set of notes tomorrow after all the details are fixed. But I'll work out exactly what the constant is. Here. Anyway, let's just leave that. I'm not sure at the moment what happens. It seems to me I get a 1 over pi here, but I don't know. I mean, I'll put it in because it appears to me that's what we get. It has to do with the matching up this measure with the dx dy. Anyway, let's just leave it like that for a minute. Okay. So we have that. Now, we have a sequence of functions from among these guys that tend weak star on the boundary. Now, the boundary values of f are, of course, in L1. So this will converge under that weak star convergence to uf. What about this side? For this side, the mu r epsilon n's, once again, go back to where we had this thing. So you have that mu r of epsilon n plus omega r epsilon n equals the good approximation, right? It's just the mu of the kj delta zj. Now down here you have an h1 function. It's not a compactly supported continuous function. It's an h1 function. It blows up at the boundary. So you're integrating against this d mu. So you have to look at the, you want to know that as you go through the sequence R epsilon n, that this guy has a limit, and that this guy goes to zero, and then therefore that this guy has a limit. This one should go to mu, this one should go to zero, and therefore this one will also go to integration with respect to mu. Now, these things, these mu kj's, how they tend to mu, they go very small, and the fact, all you have to use to handle that term is the fact that f on one of these little kj's, remember the kj's are shrinking, they're hyperbolic diameter epsilon, and on these kj's, f is very, very close to constant. It satisfies a good estimate. Yeah, except that it's even better. There's a specific rate at which it, for an H1 function, so that the errors get very small, and when you add them up, you still get something bounded by the H1 norm of f. So there's a bit of analysis there. I'll put that in the notes. Don't worry. Yeah, for an H1 function, it's f of z minus f of w is equal to or less than, well, first of all, it's equal to F times the reproducing kernel, KZ, minus the reproducing kernel, KW. Oh, that's an H1, so I shouldn't use that notation, but anyways, you can write it out. There's a, Cauchy's formula. There's a formula you write out, and just do it. I'll put it in the notes. But so this term goes fine. Once again, this is the most problematic term. How do we know that the omega r epsilon n's go to zero? We need to know that the Carlson measure norm of this thing goes to zero. Okay, why would the Carlson measure norm help? Well, there's two questions there. So first of all, however, we can also arrange to have the Carlson measure norm of this thing go to zero along the sequence, provided, and what's the condition? Well, it's the condition I wrote out before, that the Carlson measure norm was equal to or less than something like R. Well, provided this is little o of R. You remember before we had the following situation. We wanted, so we have this measure omega, and we want to estimate its Carlson measure norm. And the Carlson measure norm was estimated by some big constant times a bunch of things depending on R and epsilon. And when you look at the side length of Q, remember the cube had to have side length at least R, or it wasn't even counted. So you just get another factor of 1 over R, and you want that to be little o of R. You just want to go to 0. So you can obviously arrange by just taking capital N even bigger. You can arrange to have the Carlson measure norm go to 0 along the sequence. Then the right-hand side of star, so this is star, the right-hand side of star tends to F d mu. Ah, but I didn't explain why having the Carlson measure norm small would help, because our Carlson measure norm was defined with respect to H2, not H1. However, by the factorization theorem, the Carlson measures are the same with exactly the same norm. So I'll just write that out. Incidentally, I checked in Garnett's book, and he does make the statement somewhere that the thing just goes weak star, and he doesn't make any effort to go through the details. So here, we need to know that the, and now I'll be explicit, the H2 Carlson measure norm of a measure is the same as the H1 Carlson measure norm. So we knew that by looking at Carlson's condition, remember that Carlson condition shows you that you have H2 Carlson measure norm with certain control going to zero. We need to know that the H1 Carlson measure norm goes to zero. But that's trivial. No, it's exact. Because the factorization theorem is exact. H1 is a product of H2s with equality of the norms. So you just write it out. For example, suppose you wanted to, if F is an H1 and F equals GH from the factorization theorem, so that means that in addition to this, G is an H2, H is an H2, and the product of the H2 norms of these things is the H1 norm of F, all that, then this, of course, you can write as GH d mu, and then you apply Helder's inequality, or Cauchy-Schwarz inequality on the disk, and you get G squared d mu to the half, H squared d mu to the half. But now each of these is equal to or less than the, maybe there's a square involved here. Maybe it's this thing squared. So let's just come back to the formula in a second. So this one will be the, by definition, that's the H2 Carlson measure norm times that of F. So you get this thing squared times H2F, sorry, G, H2H. But this is by the factorization theorem. So therefore, that implies that the H1 Carlson measure norm of mu is at most the H2 Carlson measure squared, and conversely, you just have if F is an H2, then the integral of F squared d mu, you just write mod F squared as F squared mod. F squared, of course, is in H1. And that's just trivial to see that. Just look at the definition. And so this is equal to or less than mu H1 Carlson times the H1 norm of F squared, but the H1 norm of F squared is equal to or less than the H2 norm of F squared. And that implies that the H2 Carlson embedding norm, which here you're getting squared because I haven't taken square roots, is equal to or less than the H1. Okay, so like I said, it was that. Okay, so we finally have that in this approximation scheme. We can take the obvious limits on both left and right of star, and we get some sort of identity, which we think of as the Green's theorem version of the D-bar equation. So we get in the limit, so taking limits along such a sequence, right? Simultaneously, it has to be weak star convergent on the circle, and simultaneously has to satisfy all those conditions we had for the right-hand side to converge. And so we get what's called a double star. The integral over t, 1 over 2 pi I, u of z, f of z dz, is equal to integral over the disk f of z d mu z. Mu is our original Carlson measure. And again, I don't know what happened with the pi here. That's a question I'll work out for next time. Somewhere there's a pi that, according to my notes, shouldn't be there, but according to the calculation we did, should be there, so I don't know. Anyways, we now have this identity. Incidentally, why do you think of this as a Green's theorem version of the D-bar equation? Because if U were extended to be inside the circle, it's not, right? U only lives on the boundary, right? U is a weak star limit. U is only defined on T at the moment. It doesn't have an extension inside. But if it did have an extension inside, and we will provide one in momentarily, if it did have an extension inside, then you could apply Green's theorem to this thing. And what do you get? You just take the D bar inside here, and you get the D bar doesn't hit the F, it only hits the U. You get the integral of F against D bar U equals the integral of F against D mu. So you see, you would get, if U had an extension inside, you would get D bar of U equals D mu, at least when you test it against H1 functions. And that turns out to be enough, because in the corona problem, you only ever test against H1 functions. We still have to make an extension for U, which will, because the extension for U has to be a little bit better than this. Well, let's just do it. Essentially, yes. Well, let's finish this last argument, and then we can see exactly how, in what sense it's equivalent. But certainly here, we have something which, by Green's theorem, if we had U defined inside, by Green's theorem, it would be a solution. At least, almost, because it's not for every C infinity compactly supported function, it's for every H1 function. It's different testing collection, but still, good enough for our purposes. Okay. So now, suppose that d mu is 1 over pi g of z dz, where g as in corona theorem, but is a Carlson measure. So I want to point out, I'm not giving you another proof of the corona theorem here, because I'm assuming that G is in fact a Carlson measure. And remember, for the corona theorem, G is not normally a Carlson measure, so this wouldn't work even with all this effort. However, if you remember when we did the Dirichlet case, we did discover that G was a Carlson measure. And in that case, this provides another proof for that theorem. Or at least partial proof. We haven't finished the proof of the Dirichlet yet. But anyways, I'm just pointing out that this only works when G is a Carlson measure. And if you look at Garnett's book, you'll see there are other proofs where, in fact, using just the G as a Carlson measure, you can get the proof to work. But you can reduce it to the case when G is a Carlson measure. But it's a lot of hard work, much harder than Wolf's proof. But anyways, let's just suppose this now is a Carlson measure, as in the corona theorem, and let's just see that we can actually complete the theory of this equation. Then, if we put f of z, right. But in the corona theorem, g is not. I'm now assuming that d mu is g is a Carlson measure. I'm just pointing out that g is as in the corona theorem, but yeah. I'm sorry, but in the corona theorem, capital G had an independent meaning. G was actually this, where phi I was fi z bar over the length of the vector squared. This thing is not a Carlson measure. So over here, we're now making an assumption that it is. Or, anyways, so let's just do that. Because then, in this case, we can take the following simple solution that we've already put down many times, g of zeta over zeta minus v, d zeta wedge, d zeta bar. This thing satisfies ddz bar of f equals 1 over pi g. You see, when you use the residue theorem, you get that one extra 1 over pi, and it would kill this thing here. So I think somehow the if I used the residue theorem, I wouldn't have gotten this. So I don't know what happened here. It's something to do with the interplay between getting the measure and the dx dy thing. I'm not sure, because I actually didn't write out the detail, but I will for the notes. Okay, now, final application of Green's theorem. And this will do it. Where are we? Green's theorem implies 1 over 2 pi I integrate around the circle, and now little f, of course, is an h1, ei theta, and now we look at capital F, ei theta, minus u, ei theta, and then d. I mean, I could have written Z like I've written every other time, but I just want to emphasize that we're on the circle here, not in the disk, we're on the circle. And now, for Green's theorem, of course, for this term, the F times the U, we just use double star. We just use double star. And it's minus that thing. So, the second term, we use double star. So, Green's theorem and double star imply, so I'll put that one here already, and that's the sense in which double star can be thought of as a Green's theorem version of the D-bar equation, because it takes the place of actually applying Green's theorem. But now to this other term, we do apply Green's theorem, and we get 1 over 2 pi I, then you take ddz bar. See, both of these functions have an extension inside. So you can apply Green's theorem, and there are C1 extensions inside, etc. So you get just f of z times df dz bar, which is gz. So once again, my pi's are getting mixed up. I don't remember what this is. Obviously, I've gotten mixed up with my pi. Let's just ignore it. Pi is 1, and I'll figure it out in the notes. It's not that crucial. So what we have here is f, g of z, dz bar, wedge dz, minus that thing, and this is 0. So in the end, all I want to do is choose the correct multiple here so that this is 0. I want the two to cancel. And I mean, they will if I choose the mu, the relationship between mu and g correctly. Obviously, I just don't know what happened with the pi's. Something's gone amiss. Okay, what's the point of that? Once we have this 0, this is 0 for all f and h1. So what does that say? That says that this thing is in L infinity and all of its negative Fourier coefficients vanish. So in other words, it's the boundary value of an H infinity function. And that's what that provides our extension of U. Capital F minus U is in H infinity of the circle. All that means is that there is an H infinity function with these boundary values, because whenever you test against an analytic L1 function, you get 0. So we can define an extension of U to the disk by F minus U equals H. So H does have an extension to the disk, and it's just the obvious thing. U is equal to what? U is F minus H. That's for Z and D. All right, the right-hand side is defined inside the disk, and this now gives us a definition of U inside the disk. And ddz bar of U is the same as ddz bar of F, which is d mu, g or whatever. Yeah, ddz bar, we wanted it to be g. So I don't know why we wanted it to be g. If this formula was correct, let's just see what happens if I don't follow my notes. This formula, we actually got a 1 over pi. If we take that to double star, we would get... a 1 over pi there. Here, I'm not sure, but it might be g. It still might be wrong because I don't remember and I can't look it up because I don't trust my notes. But if we had ddz bar of f equals g, then I think it would work out. Where's the final Green's formula thing? It's back. Then this one would be minus 1 over pi. And yes, this is 2i dx dy. So that would say that you get 0. Obviously, something like this will work out. It's just I had a sneaking suspicion that... No, I don't know. I just don't know. If you take ddz bar of this thing... here, the 2i cancels with the 2i. Here, you should get the delta mass. Or do you get pi times the delta mass? If you get pi times the delta, then this formula is correct. And then everything I wrote is correct. So I think it's correct. But still, subject to going over it going over it later. Okay, so before we start, let's just recap where we've gotten to motivate what comes next, because the next topic after the break is going to be tuplets and Hankel operators, and we will need the duality of H1 and BMO, which turns out to be not that hard on the disk. So first, so recall that we ended up with our last corona theorem being the theorem of Nicolau. Was that H infinity intersect the Dirichlet space, has no corona. And remember where we got. This time, modulus of G dz is an H2 Carlson measure. So what we just did yields a solution B to, let's say B1, to ddz bar B1 equals G, where B1 has L infinity norm equal to or less than the Carlson measure norm of G. And of course, because we're intersecting with the Dirichlet space, I did the calculation last time, the H2 Carlson measure norm of this thing is dominated by this. So that's, which is dominated by the data in H infinity intersect D. However, we don't just need the H infinity, the L infinity norm of B1. We also want the piece corresponding to the Dirichlet term on the boundary. And that, of course, is the Besov space, B a half. And remember last time, or a couple of times ago, we did the following calculation. We also found a solution, B2 to ddz bar of B2 equals G, same equation, with, when you look at the Besov space norm on the circle, B2, it's also controlled by the data in D H infinity intersect D. But as I pointed out, what we need is a single B with, of course, the solution equals G, and we need simultaneously the two things. That is, B in L infinity intersect B a half, too. Equal to or less than a constant. So we have one B that satisfies the L infinity part, a different B that satisfies the Besov part. What we want is a single B that satisfies simultaneously both dominated by this. Because then, when you subtract B from the in the causal complex, you end up with a holomorphic thing whose this norm is controlled. And for a holomorphic function, this norm is the same as that norm, because it's holomorphic. So let me just say, by way of motivation, this we will get using the theory of Hankel operators. So this difficulty will be solved using a characterization of B half 2 let's just say using Hankel operators. The idea will be that if you have a function B on the circle, its norm in the Besov space, B a half 2, is actually equal to the Hilbert-Schmidt norm of HB, the Hankel operator, corresponding to B. And once we know that, that's actually easy. It's just Fourier analysis, real easy. But then there's the theorem of Peller and Khrushchev that shows that if you can express the norm of your space in terms of the singular numbers of the Hankel operator, which is trace class, it's just sum of the squares of the, or the sum of the singular numbers, which is sum of the squares of the eigenvalues, if it had eigenvalues. Anyways, that thing for a compact operator, just sum of singular numbers. What they show is that if you minimize the L infinity norm over solutions to this thing, if you minimize the L infinity norm by subtracting off appropriate holomorphic pieces, the B a half norm is minimized simultaneously, or at least almost minimized. It comes within a constant. So by minimizing the L infinity norm, you simultaneously minimize this thing. And that's because you show that when you minimize the L infinity norm, the singular numbers don't increase. They only go down. So therefore, if some norm is depending only on the singular numbers, it can't go up either. It's got to go down. So it's complicated, but it motivates what we will do next, which is calculating the boundedness and compactness of Toeplitz operators and Hankel operators. And basically, Toeplitz operators are somehow the restriction or compression of multiplier operators to H2, and the Hankel operators are what remains. They turn out to be a commutator, and they're much better behaved. Anyways, it's a good, and that's where we'll need the H1 BMO duality is for Hankel operators. So after a 15-minute break, because this is a longer day, we'll start with Toeplitz and Hankel operators. And as I said, on Wednesday, I will send Jason a new file of notes with the corrections. Okay. So according to my notes, we're now on what's called section 4, but I think that's a cheat. It's really the third section. We've done interpolation, we've done corona, and it's taken us 60 pages of 300. We're not going to finish. But we will get through the Toeplitz and Hankel operators, and I was hoping to also get through the next section, which is the higher dimensional stuff, which is more new. If we will probably get started sometime before the end of March, and as I say, at the end of March the course officially ends, so I don't even know if anybody's officially registered and needs a mark, but at that point that will be done. And then after, or in April when I get back, if there's interest among some people, we'll just continue going through the same notes, because there's so many mistakes I have to go through it anyway. I like to lecture on it, because then I, especially with hearing everybody's comments. But it will be unofficial then, and not official. Okay, so Toeplitz and Hankel operators. Okay, so we start off with e to the in theta, an orthonormal basis of L2 of the circle. Using the measure d theta over 2 pi. So let phi be an L infinity function on the circle. Incidentally, L infinity of t is the multiplier space of L2 of t. Right? No holomorphic stuff here, just square integrable functions. The set of measurable functions which, when you multiply them by L2, you stay in L2, are the bounded ones. And the norm of the operator of multiplication coincides with the L infinity norm. I mean, you just look at where the function phi takes its soup, and you can find L2 functions nearby, et cetera, et cetera. So that's just an elementary exercise. So we let phi be in L infinity, which is the multipliers of L2, and compute the matrix representation of the multiplier operator m phi relative to the orthonormal basis B. Well, what is it? Because this is what motivates the definitions we're going to look at. So what is the thing? It's m I'm going to have to constantly look things up here, because the algebra gets messy. Not messy, it's too many choices, 50-50 choices, and it's so easy to choose wrong. So M of JK is defined to be, and now we take M of phi acting on zk, inner product zj. Okay, so whenever you write down a matrix representation relative to a basis, it's convention to flip the j and the k, so that m phi applied to, say, the function 1 is the column through k equals 0. So if I write this all out, it's a huge array. If this is I didn't bring my picture with me. So generally, I think of J, the first component, as indexing the rows. So that means J will be this index. K will be columns. And to write this out, let's look at the Fourier series. Of course, phi is an L infinity function. It's certainly L2. It has an L2 Fourier series. So Let's look at the Fourier coefficients. If phi is equal to the sum over n and z, phi hat n, zn, of course this is z equals ei theta. Incidentally, in this world of tuplets and Hankel operators, z is used as a variable on the circle, and it's also used as a variable in the disk. And usually it's used with the understanding that the variable inside is the Poisson or Cauchy extension of something's holomorphic, et cetera, et cetera. But we'll have to be explicit when we do it. But they like to use z as a variable rather than e to the I theta. So if this is for us, we don't really care in what sense. This is obviously in the L2 norm, or by Carlson's theorem that we won't prove in this course, almost every theta. Then we can work this thing out. What is m phi on zk? Well, you take this function and multiply it by z to the k. When you multiply it by z to the k, you get that function. You then inner product with z to the j. So you pick out the coefficient when n plus k equals j. So you pick the coefficient n when j minus k. So what does this look like in our picture? Let's draw a bigger picture. So in particular, if you look at m phi of 1, that's the case when k is 0, right? When k is 0, that's the function 1 on the circle. And m phi of 1 is what? Well, the Fourier coefficients are just the phi hat j's. So along here, that's this column where k is 0. And this is J. So this set of values that you get for the matrix representation here is just what I would call the sequence phi hat. It's just the sequence phi hat. Because when K is 0, you just get phi hat of J. So at every point J, you get phi hat of J. So this is just the sequence J equals minus infinity plus infinity. And then what does it look like elsewhere? Well, you'll notice that for a multiplication operator, you have this very special form. It doesn't depend on J and K independently. It depends only on their difference, J minus K. So that means you simply take this thing, and it has to be constant on all the main diagonals. So you basically just take this thing and shift it up. So, for example, you just move this thing like that. So you simply take these values and you shift them up 45 degrees. And that gives you the set of all elements in your matrix. Equivalently, some people, at least the Russians I'm following the article of Peller and Khrushchev, by the way. So that's when I say these people, I mean those two. They wrote out a very concise introduction to tuplets and Hankel operators, which I've adapted. Somebody else has a book that does it too, but I haven't looked at that. However, it seems people like to look at the corresponding row. Now, the corresponding row, if you think about it, is just because of the shifting thing, is just going to be the reflection of the blue thing. So this is just going to be phi hat reflected about the origin. In other words, phi hat of minus j. If you like, j is now 0, and the Fourier coefficients are phi hat of minus k instead of phi hat of k. And similarly, you can think of this thing being lifted up, just same thing, like that. We're going to call the coefficients that come along here, we're going to call these a sub k. So they're really phi hat of minus k. So the fact that we're passing from a column to a row introduces this funny negative sign, which annoys me no end, but I don't know. I don't know what the best way to present this stuff is. But you do have to be consistent. Whatever you start with, stick with it. So, we could, with this notation, say that the multiplier operator so M phi has the Fourier coefficients phi hat of j minus k, or if we flip it around the other way, a sub k minus j. Where AK is the reflection. So in other words, I'm using the horizontal thing as a reference point instead of the column. It's the convention that Peller and Khrushchev use. They use this. Okay, now we would like to consider the following sort of operation. Instead of defining this multiplier operator, M phi, on all of L2, let's just define it on H2. So that means we're only going to assign it values where K is non-negative. That means we're only going to work out to the right. We're going to ignore the ones to the left. Let's just restrict F to be in H2. Or if you like, look at the orthogonal projection from the whole thing onto H2, the orthogonal projection, and just work from there. Then we apply the M phi operator, and of course the M phi operator will take us back into L2. We would then like to restrict that back to H2, which means we're going to artificially project it back onto here. And if we do that, the matrix representation in the basis for H2, which is just the ZK with K non-negative and J non-negative, will have the same coefficients. And they'll be given by this thing. So we're going to give a name to that. Here's our definition. We want to define, give a name to all the operators from H2 to H2 that look like they come from this type of restriction of a multiplier operator. And we call it a Toeplitz operator. So a linear operator defined on whose domain of definition, a linear operator whose domain of definition includes let's call it B plus. That's the set of Z to the N, N equal to or greater than 0. So this is, of course, a basis for H2, right? The analytic ones. So a linear operator whose domain of definition includes B plus is called a Toeplitz operator if the matrix representation relative to that basis B plus, which is by definition B, ZK, ZJ, with J and K both non-negative. I guess that's outside. Okay, we're just looking at the non-negative ones. And whose range, and with range, in H2, is called a tuplets operator if it's matrix representation. So far this is the definition. The condition is that it's A, or actually B, sub K minus J. Yeah, I used A here. I should have used something different. I should have used C, because A is going to be used for something else. So where did I come up with the A? Here. Let's call it little c. Okay, so we have a linear operator defined on at least the polynomials, linear space, actually just right, linear sum of z to the n's. So it's defined on at least the polynomials, and it maps into H2. And we say it's a tuplets operator simply if its matrix representation has this feature that it's constant on the main diagonals. That's the condition. So i.e., matrix is constant on the main diagonals. Because if it came from a multiplication operator, it would be constant on the main diagonals. And what we're going to show, of course, is that such a linear operator is bounded if and only if there is a multiplication operator with a phi, such that all this happens and a whole bunch of other stuff. So that's our definition of a tuplets operator. What about a Hankel operator? Well, a Hankel operator, remember the idea was we wanted to restrict F to be an H2, apply our operator to it, so that leaves us in this half, but then we further restricted the range to lie in the analytic part, and we have ignored this so far. So now we want to include this part. And in this part, I won't write it all out again, I'll just give you the definition, but in this part, what's the orthonormal basis for L2 minus H2? It's all these things, typically called H2 minus, and it's generated, the basis B minus is the set of all Z bar to the n, n equals or greater than 1. Right? Because it's negative. E to the minus I theta, e to the minus 2 I theta, e to the minus 3 I theta. And of course, e to the minus theta is just z bar. So I'm sort of reordering, and instead of calling these basis items z to the minus 1, z to the minus 2, I'm calling them z bar to the 1, z bar to the 2, just replacing the minus sign by bar. And if I do that, if this operator, now we're going to take a function f in H2, apply the multiplication operator to it, and then now project it down to this orthogonal complement, project it down here instead. What do the matrix coefficients look like? Well, they're the it's the same thing. It's this red thing shifted always, right? You just keep shifting this thing. And where is it going to be constant? Well, it's going to be constant on the original main diagonals, these things. However, if we now switch the, since I've switched minus and positive by denoting these j going 1 to 2 to the n, these are the places where j plus k is constant. So now, if you simply look at it from upside down, the matrix representation is constant on the cross diagonals. Any such operator whose matrix representation from B plus to B minus has this constant on cross diagonals thing is called a Hankel operator. And again, the main theorem is that Hankel operator is bounded if and only if it comes from a multiplication operator, blah, 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 blah. But with something more interesting thrown in, because it's an error operator. Okay, so here's our definition of Hankel. Okay. So a linear operator, A, we'll make it look like the other one, whose domain of definition includes B plus, and whose range actually, it's a little bit much to say that the range is actually in H2, but I'm probably going to change this. You see, to say that the range, I guess it's okay because my domain of definition is just a small set, right? It certainly contains the polynomials, which are dense in L2, H2. But since it's not dense, to say that the range is in H2 minus isn't really too restrictive. I really don't want to restrict it at all, other than saying that whatever the values are, their Fourier coefficients are in the right range. That's all I really wanted to say. I don't really mean to imply that they're square summable yet. But this is really not much of a loss of generality. And whose range is in here, is a Hankel operator. If its matrix representation relative to B plus B minus is, and what's the matrix representation? As always, it's A, we have to be careful now, A, Z, K, and of course K is going to be equal to or greater than 0 because the domain has frequencies K equal to or greater than 0. I'm using here, by the way, this inner product is the L2 inner product on the circle. I maybe didn't say that, but all of this action takes place in the overriding Hilbert space L2 of the circle. Here, I want to take the basis B minus, which is I've relabeled as Z bar N for N equal to or greater than 1. So let's take Z bar J, J equal to or greater than 1. So here, we've now... So the K is still the same, non-negative, but now instead of having Z to the J, J equal to or greater than 0, I want the other frequencies. So it's Z bar to the J, J equal to or greater than 1. And the condition, of course, for this to look like it comes from a multiplier operator is for it to have A, J plus K, i.e. constant on cross diagonals. So these definitions are designed to be fairly weak, right? They basically just reflect an algebraic property of the matrix representation. Of course, it's designed to somehow capture multiplier operators, and the theorems will be, I mean, we already have an example. If you have a multiplier operator, maybe I should just write that down right away before we go any further. To every multiplier operator, you can easily associate a tuplets and a Hankel operator just by the matrices that we drew. So maybe I'll just put example. If C is in L infinity, then here's an example of a tuplets operator. We want to define it on a domain that includes the z to the k's. Well, H2 does. So I'm going to define it actually on all of H2. So we take multiply by phi. That's the operation of m phi. And then we want this to live back in H2. We want the Fourier coefficients to be non-negative. So we take P plus. And this is where P plus equals orthogonal projection from L2 to the closed subspace H2. In terms of the Fourier coefficients, the projection operator is really, really simple. You erase all the negative coefficients and make them zero. That's obviously the projection. Just coordinate projection on the Fourier coefficients. And of course, this actually gives B as a well-defined bounded operator. Why is it bounded? Well, multiplication by an L-infinity function is bounded on L2, and projection takes you into L2. It's a projection. It's norm at most 1. You're just throwing some Fourier coefficients away. So B is bounded on H2, and in fact, the norm of B as an operator is equal to or less than the L-infinity norm of phi, which is the norm of the multiplication operator on L2. So B is bounded on H2, and it's trivial to verify that the matrix representation is equal to what we said earlier, phi hat of J minus K, which, of course, you can write in the form B of K minus J, where B is the set phi hat reflected, or the sequence phi hat reflected. And that's our definition for a tuplets operator. So there's an example of a tuplets operator that happens to be bounded. The reason we started with an L-infinity function was so that this operation was bounded on L2, right? Otherwise, I mean, we want this to be a multiplier on L2. What about an example of the corresponding Hankel operator? It's the same thing. And if we define A to be, well, what are we going to do again? Same type of thing. You start with an H2 function. You multiply it by this L infinity function phi. You're now in L2. And now you want to project onto H2 minus, the thing with strictly negative Fourier coefficients. In other words, it's the complement to P plus. So, and this happens for F and H2. And this is where P minus is orthogonal projection onto L2 minus H2, which we call H2 minus. In other words, it's the set of all functions on L2, in L2 of the circle, whose Fourier coefficients with k equal to or greater than zero vanish, right? Only the strictly negative coefficients survive. So again, the norm of A is equal to or equal to or less than L infinity norm of phi, and the matrix representation is phi hat of minus k minus j. I mean, I haven't gone through that, but it is, because the multiplication operator has these coefficients. But remember, on the downstairs part, I flipped my k around and replaced k by minus k. So it's actually phi hat of j plus. Uh-oh. Now, I knew I would get into trouble. It's J that gets flipped, not K. You have to watch me carefully. It's so hard to get this right. It's J that gets flipped, so it's J that gets replaced, and it's minus J, minus K, which is equal to A, J plus K, if A is the reflection of phi hat. So it's still consistent. Okay, so now there are two theorems. And the theorems say these are the only bounded tuplets and Hankel operators. That's the important theorem. Every bounded tuplets operator comes from one of these, plus we'll compute exactly what the norm is, and similarly for Hankel. The norm here is fairly simple. It's simply the infimum of all the L-infinity norms it's just the L-infinity norm of phi, period. That's a good point. I should mention a couple of obvious things about these operators. First of all, the operator B, the tuplets operator, is uniquely determined by the phi. That's, at least in this example, and that's because, or even in the definition too, because as J and K are non-negative, B of K minus J covers B from minus infinity to plus infinity. And when it's phi hat, it covers all the coefficients, under the B. They're all covered, right? As J and K are non-negative, you get all possible coefficients here. So the matrix involves all the Fourier coefficients of phi hat. In other words, depends uniquely on phi. That's not true for A. For A, J is equal to or greater than zero. K is equal to or greater than zero. J is equal to or greater than one. I've lost it. Here. K is equal to or greater than zero. J is equal to or greater than one. That means that these numbers here only live in the negative integers. Nothing zero or higher. So obviously, this phi here is not uniquely determined by the operator, by the matrix anyways, which is the same as the operator. Because if you change phi by modifying some of its non-negative Fourier coefficients, nothing happens to the matrix representation of the operator. Therefore, the operator is the same. So let's just say that, note that phi in L infinity here is uniquely determined by the matrix representation of B, hence by B, but not by the matrix representation of A, which doesn't see non-negative Fourier coefficients. So as I say, the two theorems that we prove, one theorem says that if you have a tuplets operator, then there exists a unique phi in L infinity such that this happens, that it comes from a multiplier. When it comes to a Hankel operator, if we have a bounded Hankel operator, then there does not exist a unique phi. There does exist an L infinity function phi such that it's given like this. Moreover, the norm of A will be the least L infinity norm of such representations. And you can also compute that by using the standard functional analysis that we've done many times with quotient spaces, etc. It's the distance of this function in L infinity from the closed subspace H infinity. That just all comes out for free. And that's called Nahari's theorem. What is harder, well, it's also true, and Nahari didn't bother mentioning it, I don't think, but it's also true that this phi can be computed by its norm on the Hardy space H1 of 0. That's using the factorization theorem. But then to know its norm on the space H1 of 0, you have to know Pfefferman's theorem. Now, first of all, this thing's action on H1 of 0 means that we can take the P minus part of it, well, some projection of it, whichever way works. And Pfefferman's theorem says that you can compute that using the BMO norm. And that requires a little bit more work to prove that the dual of H1 is BMO. But that gives them the full Nahari theorem, which is you can also compute the norm of this thing by looking at its projection onto the H2 minus space and computing the BMO norm of that projection. No, if you're going to use the L infinity norm of phi, you have to use the right one. You have to use the minimum one. That's also equal to the distance of any phi to H infinity. They all have the same distance to H infinity. It's also equal to the BMO norm of P minus phi for any phi, because all the phis have the same P minus, right? They have the same projection, because that's what matters. The projection is uniquely determined by the operator, but you can change the holomorphic part at random. So again, it's the BMO norm of the P minus. Anyway, I'm going to write it out, but I just wanted to say in advance what to look for. I guess we'll finally erase this picture. We don't need it. No. Yeah, that's in my notes. Yeah. Probably I'll mention that next time. But yeah, another way to see, to characterize these operators in a more operator theoretic fashion is that our definition of the Toeplitz operator has the property that the shift operator on H2, that's the shift on H2, commutes with B. And our, no, not, well, not quite. So here, let me look at that. It's unfortunate that I can never remember these things. But you have to be careful, because the shift takes you out of the space P2 minus. That's the only catch. Otherwise, it's like it commutes. So I wasn't planning to do this, which is why I don't have it on the tip of my... Okay. So F is the unilateral shift on H2, called unilateral because it doesn't have an inverse on H2. It can't go backwards. It has an adjoint, but it's not the inverse. And script S is the bilateral shift on L2. It obviously is invertible. It goes back and forth. The inverse is multiplied by e to the minus theta. And the condition that you write down at the bottom of page 62, A is Hankel if A